You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 16th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, a brand new addition to the Monocle 24 lineup, coming to you live not just from Midori House, but also just down the road from the Monocle Cafe here in beautiful Marylebone, with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Andrew Tuck on today's show.
There can be no games, no room for avoidance, or anything less than full compliance by the Assad regime.
George Brock and Greg Beichmann will be here to discuss Syria and the media. Then we ask whether educating foreign presidents improves a country's soft power.
Was Rouhani made more modern, more outward-facing because of his time studying in a Western university? Or was it because he is quite forward and outward-looking that he decided to study at a Western university?
Alistair Gee takes a look at the America's Cup.
Everything's fast, so that means that your reaction times have to be quicker, your anticipation has to be better. You chew up a mile in about 2 or 3 minutes.
And later on, join me, Andrew Tuck, at the Monocle Cafe, where I'll preview this week's 100% design event in London with its director, Will Knight.
We'll also have new music from Arcade Fire, and we'll look ahead to the rest of the day on Monocle 24 with Tom Lewis and Marcus Hippie. That's Aperitivo with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Andrew Tuck, right now on Monocle 24. So, a new week, a new show. Lots to fit in. But first, here's David Spencer with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. At least six people have been killed in a shooting at the huge US Navy base in Washington, D.C. Several others have been injured in the attack. One of the dead is a Navy police officer, while one attacker has also been killed. Officials believe there are two other gunmen still at large on the base. Washington Police Chief Kathy Lanier has issued descriptions.
That white male was last seen around 8:35 this morning with a handgun. We also have a lookout potentially for another shooter involved. That was a black male, approximately 50 years of age, who may have been in possession of a long gun. We have no information to believe that either of those folks are military personnel, but we do have information that those individuals are wearing military-style uniforms.
President Barack Obama has been briefed on the incident and has just issued this statement.
We offer our gratitude to the Navy and local law enforcement, federal authorities, and the doctors who've responded with skill and bravery. I've made it clear to my team that I want the investigation to be seamless so that federal and local authorities are working together. And as this investigation moves forward, we will do everything in our power to make sure whoever carried out this cowardly act is held responsible.
As many as 3,000 people, mainly civilians, work at the base, which engineers, purchases, builds and maintains ships and submarines for the Navy. The Washington Yard is the US Navy's oldest shore installation. The United Nations has confirmed that chemical weapons have been used in Syria. It says its report has established unequivocally and objectively that sarin gas was used in a rocket attack in the Syrian capital Damascus last month, although it has not attributed blame. Well, powers will now try to hammer out a UN Security Council resolution, as the United States warns that military action could still take place against President Assad if he fails to hand over his chemical arsenal. Helicopter gunships have been brought in by government forces in the Philippines in an attempt to dislodge Muslim rebels who've been holding parts of the city of Zamboanga for the past week. The insurgents say they want to establish an independent Muslim state. Zamboanga has been brought to a standstill by the week-long siege. An unknown number of civilians are still being held. Greek police have fired tear gas in angry confrontations with striking school staff as public sector workers begin a week of strikes to protest against planned layoffs. Guards who patrol schools and oversee road crossings, teachers and public hospital doctors are starting walkouts to put pressure on the government ahead of their planned cuts. Thousands have marched through the streets of Athens, but Education Minister Konstantinos Avanitopoulos believes the unions are trying to strike fear across the education system.
I've said many times in the parliament that there is no such fear for the educational community, but at the same time, we need to go forward with all the structural reforms that will make our educational system better and less wasteful.
Bombardier's new C-Series airliner has had its maiden flight. It took off from the Mirabel factory in Quebec to cheers from watching crowds, capping a five-year, $3.4 billion development of the first all-new plane in its class in decades. Already 9 months behind schedule, the maiden flight had been delayed by around a week due to poor weather. The 110 to 130-seat C-Series is Bombardier's bid to break into the lower end of the market for medium-haul jets, traditionally dominated by Airbus and Boeing. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
David Spencer, thank you very much. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're right back after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Aperitivo. The time in Istanbul is 20.06. It's 18.06 here in London and 13.06 in New York City. Time now for us to take a fresh look at the top stories around the world today. Joining me now with their take on the news are George Brock and Gregory Beichmann. George is the head of journalism at City University and the author of a new book, Out of Print, Newspapers, Journalism and the Business of News in the Digital Age. Welcome, George.
Thank you very much.
Gregory is Global Head of Multimedia at Reuters. Welcome to you, Gregory.
Thank you.
We're going to start the show with the latest on Syria. Just before we came on air, the United Nations inspectors released its report on the use of chemical weapons. It confirmed their use in Ghouta on the 21st of August and pointed, as diplomatically and carefully as one would expect, to Syrian government forces as the perpetrators. The deal agreed by US Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov is already, understandably, under pressure. And Kerry today, with the UK and France, announced that they won't tolerate any delays in the process. Before Greg, George, we speak, let's first of all hear from Secretary Kerry.
We agreed that Syria must submit within a week, not in 30 days, but in 1 week, a comprehensive listing, and additional details will be addressed regarding that in the coming days. That to accomplish our goal, this plan had to produce transparency, accountability, timeliness, and enforceability. It must be credible and verifiable. If fully implemented, we believe it can meet these standards. The world will now expect the Assad regime to live up to its public commitments. And as I said at the outset of these negotiations, there can be no games, no room for avoidance, or anything less than full compliance by the Assad regime.
George, John Kerry wants full compliance from the Assad regime, but obviously, as we've discovered over the past few days, it's not really going to be as simple as that, is it?
First of all, it's an enormously complicated task. Nobody quite knows how much stuff the Assad regime has got, but people reckon 1,000 tons of stuff. Now, 1,000 tons of stuff in a country of that size, that isn't something you can just check up on in a matter of hours or possibly even a few days. So the first thing is the task is very big. Almost every chemical weapons monitoring expert who anybody's ever talked to says, this is really big scale stuff, this. This is not, we're just not looking for a few cans here.
Well, and also this is going to have to happen in a war zone. This isn't like Libya in 2003 when Gaddafi was like, look, they're here, come and get them. It's not indeed even like Iraq in 1991 after the first Iraq war when Saddam agreed to give up a lot of his weapons.
Plus the fact that moving around the country is extremely dangerous and not always possible.
I mean, I'm going to go with maybe the meta story here, which is that I think the reality of sourcing 1,000 tons of chemical weapons and the reporting and everything that's going to be required to follow up is going to take a very long time. But what they have achieved is it's now highly unlikely that anyone will use chemical weapons. Certainly the Assad government won't use chemical weapons. And that's probably, arguably, the chief goal that they sought to achieve by even considering a military strike. And the second point is, you know, there is now going to be more focus on arming the rebels, which is probably something that people were thinking about anyway. But now they've got a sort of clear agenda and a clear set of, sort of cooperation from the people who make up the UN. But I think it's the fact that ultimately there won't be further use of chemical weapons by the Assad government, which they can sort of point to as a success.
They can point to that, yes, but you know, possibly residents of Damascus will be pointing out that within hours of the deal being signed, heavy weaponry that had been taken away because of the fear of attack suddenly reappeared, and people were being killed with conventional weapons once again.
But that really isn't anything new, is it? At the end of the day, you know, I think the facts on the ground haven't changed. Almost no government is really willing to step in and take a strong stand to support either side, bar, you know, the Russians with Assad.
Almost everyone in this deal was a winner, except for the Syrian rebels.
Fair.
Who, okay, are not now going to be the targets of chemical weapons, but they are going to be the targets of everything else. But what that reflects is the fact that no one can win this civil war. The situation essentially mirrors the really basic situation, military situation on the ground, which is nobody is decisively winning.
You say everyone's a winner apart from the rebels. Scott Lucas, one of our commentators earlier, was talking about how he believes it was actually a bit of a setback for the US. Let's hear from him now.
The framework agreement with Russia to get rid of Syrian chemical weapons is a huge setback for the United States, at least in international terms. It provides a way out domestically for President Obama, who effectively had trapped himself into saying he might go ahead with airstrikes, but then basically wobbled in the face of possible opposition from Congress and the public. But internationally, what it looks like is that the Americans, who had basically said we are not going to let the chemical weapons attack by the Assad regime go unpunished, we're not even going to rely on the United Nations, we'll go ahead anyway, that President Obama completely walked that back within 24 hours, and now 3 weeks later, this proposed agreement with the Russians, what in effect allows the Assad regime to do is to continue attacking the insurgents as long as it doesn't use chemical weapons.
George, when you hear that from Scott, I mean, why is it your view that actually Obama's actually done okay out of this?
Everything is incredibly uncertain and provisional in these situations. It all depends on what you consider to be a setback. Obama had talked himself, his own mistake, into a situation in where he was facing possible defeat in Congress. What I meant when I said he'd won was this deal allows him to avoid what would have been a considerably more humiliating defeat in Congress. It's all relative. It's not been great for him, but then again, it hasn't been a disaster either.
Yeah, I think if you're coming at it from the neoconservative perspective, this is absolutely a slap in the face for the United States. Clearly, many people in the U.S. and many outside look for the U.S. to be the enforcer of international norms. I mean, even I've found myself wavering between the two and sort of feeling like there ought to be a cause for action and ought to be some action. And the other side of me saying, well, maybe it is time to turn a leaf and turn a page and rely more on international institutions. And actually, ultimately, I think that's what's happening here. It'll be really interesting to see, you know, does this result in a stronger Security Council and a stronger, more respected United Nations, which clearly in the last, well, really for much of its existence, has been not given as much serious weight as it might deserve.
Is there also an argument, you know, looking for silver linings, you know, desperately grasping at straws, that the fact that Kerry and Lavrov were able to get together, were able to have this agreement, and are able to even talk about, can we bring Iran into the fold at some stage? It lays some sort of a groundwork for further peace talks that might try to end the civil war further down the line?
I think that door is very arguably open. I mean, there have already been letters exchanged, apparently remotely, between Obama and Hosseini, and there's possibility of meeting on the sidelines of the Security Council meeting next week. It's all out there, isn't it? It's as we heard earlier, it really is a time of uncertainty. I think very difficult to know where it's going, but I think the point I'd make is that it is a very different route from what we would have seen 10 years ago, a very different route, and it does have many people nervous, particularly those who look for that authority out of the United States.
But let's not lose sight of the fact that democracies always have difficulties when dealing with authoritarian or totalitarian states. They're always going to have difficulty in foreign policy. What has really basically happened here is that public opinion in Europe and America has moved against these kinds of military interventions, really decisively. You had Cameron out on a limb, discovering he did not have the public support and, in fact, being defeated in his own parliament. Obama almost went through the same experience. On the whole, we should celebrate the fact that elected representatives take notice of public opinion. Inconvenient, difficult, sometimes even humiliating. But it should be happening.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. Ultimately, I mean, the fact that they chose to take it to vote is a really interesting, you know, argument that they will actually listen, that they are going to have some faith in the electorate. Whereas before, I mean, I think everyone expected the attack to simply go ahead without going for a vote.
And finally, just on this point, I mean, is it arguable, George, that actually this is just what diplomacy looks like? And we haven't really seen much of this over the past 10 years or so. Diplomacy's been used as sort of as a means to an end, the end being, well, we're going to have an attack and we'll talk about exploring all paths of diplomacy, you know, before we get there. But this has been actual diplomacy. It's been messy. It's been a little bit ugly at times, but it seems to have got some sort of a result.
And let's also say it's diplomacy in fantastically difficult conditions. I mean, the uncertainties and the unexpected things coming out of the Middle East, which are outfoxing everyone, are unlike almost anything in my lifetime. And diplomacy is always long, it's always messy, and you do need some kind of threat of force behind it, but it's much better if you don't ever have to use it.
We're going to leave it there for just one moment. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. I'm joined here by George Brock and Greg Beichmann. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll head down to the Monocle Cafe to talk to our editor, Andrew Tuck, and we'll also speak to George and Greg about the soft power effects of a foreign education.
The Aperitivo is brought to you in association with the Glenlivet. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all, and on it lives.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Aperitivo. It's 21:18 in Moscow, 18:18 here in London. We're going to head over now to the Monocle Cafe, which, as I'm sure you know by now, is a mere 200 yards or so down the road here on Chiltern Street. Andrew Tuck, our editor, is down there now. Andrew, you're going to be interviewing Will Knight a little bit later. But we thought we'd first of all just catch up with you to have a little bit of chat about what Aperitivo is all about. Hello, Andrew.
Hello. Well, if you want to know what time it is here, it's coffee time.
Excellent. You've got your flat white.
We need that on our time checks. Yeah, I'm down here in the cafe, which we're going to be using for some of the interviews we do on Aperitivo, because it's a cosy spot. It's good to get people away from the studio. It's a well-designed spot as well, so it's perfectly relevant for our first conversation with Will Knight, who's organised 100% Design, the big design show for London this week.
Now, tell us where exactly you are in the cafe. I can just hear some, was that police or an ambulance going past at the end of the road?
They're not coming to get me just yet. I'm kind of leaning against a nice shelf. I've got the whole cafe team behind me. They haven't made me wear an apron just yet.
Okay.
I'm wearing one, actually. They're rather smart.
There's time.
That's time, I'm sure. And I've tried to keep my hands off the sticky buns.
Okay, good. And let's just clear up one more final thing before we talk back to our guests here. Aperitivo, not Aperitivo.
Well, Steve, you're from Birmingham. I think you're murdering it every single time you say it. So apart from that, I think anybody else who has a go at it is fine.
Okay, good. Andrew, we'll join you a little bit later after the news at 1:30, where you'll be with Will Knight. Until then, thank you very much. You're listening to Aperitivo on Monocle 24. And I'm still here with George Brock from City University and Greg Beichmann from Reuters. It seems that no mention of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani is complete without the prefix Glasgow educated. Rouhani gained his PhD at the city's Caledonian University in the 1990s. But mildly diverting trivia aside, is it at all relevant? We talk a lot about soft power, but does Rouhani's British education make him view the West differently? The trial of Saif Gaddafi, incidentally, begins in Libya later this week. His studies at LSE cause that institution no end of problems. George, any interesting potential future presidents at City at the moment?
Who knows? We certainly think we've got a lot of talent we're teaching. I've just said hello to our next cohort and the MA in International Journalism. Who knows? There may be important politicians waiting there to emerge. I would guess... that if you educate people from elsewhere, they will, on average, think better about your culture and your country when they go back. But there are two quite large buts. In one case, for example, Saif Gaddafi doing his PhD at the LSE, it just doesn't work. And secondly, it can also go into reverse. One of the founders of the Muslim Brotherhood, Said Qutb, went to Colorado, of all places in the United States, back in the 1950s, and wrote when he got back a very, very famous article in Egypt, where he came from, saying what I think of the United States. As you might probably imagine, what he thought of the United States was not much.
I think he even got propositioned, didn't he, on the boat on the way over,
yep,
which didn't help.
Absolutely everything he didn't like about American culture, sexual promiscuity, reliance on alcohol.
It all began right there.
Right along to the haircuts. I mean, it all began right there, and it went ghastly into reverse. As I say, net on average, probably a good thing.
Yeah, I think we see sometimes more out of these things than actually exists. I would agree. There's a nice framework of education that those leaders can refer to, and certainly an openness of dialogue and questioning they would have been subject to during their education. But I think we look at them and we want to see more than actually exists.
Okay, well, I slightly disagree with you on that, but we're going to come back to you on that moment in a bit. I want to hear, though, first from the author and Iran expert, David Patrikarakos, who spoke to us a little bit earlier about Rouhani's education at Glasgow Caledonian University.
First and foremost, it's necessary to understand that he didn't actually live in Scotland. I mean, he commuted from Tehran, and while he did spend quite an amount of time there, and many of his professors remember him quite fondly, he didn't spend many years there. He didn't move to Scotland, as it were. So he was sort of to and from Tehran with just periods of time spent in Scotland. So it's not as if he up sticks and left the Islamic Republic for a sustained amount of time. I do think, however, that the experience is important. With these Islamic Republic guys, a lot of the time it's a question of chicken and egg. Was Rouhani made more modern, more outward-facing because of his time studying in a Western university? Or was it because he is quite forward and outward looking that he decided to study at Western University? I think the experience can only be positive. You have to understand, for example, that when the Islamic Republic first came, when the revolutionaries first took power, there were huge purges, you know, of the army and also of the foreign and diplomatic service. And I've spoken to Iranians who were very young at the time and found themselves in very senior positions in Iran's foreign ministry, for example, quite simply because they actually knew something about the world. I mean, they were surrounded by mullahs that had been shipped in from Qom who had never heard of the United Nations. So I think any kind of sort of foreign experience, foreign education is a good thing, especially in an Iranian president that has to deal with the West.
David Patrikarakos there on Rouhani's education at Glasgow Caledonian University. George, David sort of nails it there by saying, well, look, it's a bit of a chicken and egg. Is it because he was really open to the West that he came here, or does coming here make him more open to the West? If you were foreign secretary in this country now, would you be thinking, well, maybe we should just offer, you know, 1,000 places on master's programmes to the top Iranian students, and that might help us in the long run?
They could do a great deal worse, and it shouldn't be confined to Iran either. There's a scholarship, well-known scholarship scheme at the Foreign Office called the Chevening Scheme, which does this kind of thing. That doesn't necessarily bring people for full university courses. And like everything else the Foreign Office has been doing in the last few years, its funds have been cut back and cut back and cut back. And to the despair of a lot of diplomats who understand what the soft power of education can do. It's not a perfect guarantee it'll work. Odds are that it will.
Greg, why are you so skeptical of this?
I don't know. Look, I don't want to come off deeply skeptical of it. I just think that we, you know, ultimately leaders will serve the interests of, you know, their populace and of the things that they think are strategically important for their country. And that will always have priority over any, you know, sort of ties or sort of traditions they have relating to their education. That's all. It's simply an argument that reality will often weigh over. I think if you, you know, expect Rouhani to sort of roll over and throw on a kilt and walk around with a bagpipe and you know, think things are going to work wonderfully with the West, I think they'd be a bit naive. The reality is he's got a nuclear issue and program to resolve. There have been some early sort of outreaches which sound positive, but the truth is there's still every potential for a genuine train smash around this issue, including military action. And I think that is going to outweigh, you know, the positive things he would have picked up during his education.
Let's talk about those issues that you just raised there, because as we were discussing earlier, Iran has sort of been brought into the fold in the Syria discussions. There's a possibility that Rouhani might meet with Obama on the sidelines at the UN General Assembly, perhaps more likely that they'll meet more at a foreign minister level, Kerry with his counterpart in Iran. It's very easy for us to sort of perhaps read a bit too much into this. I mean, the other prefix that Rouhani gets is moderate, but these things are all comparative, aren't they? I mean,
Didn't they think Khatami was moderate at first because of the members-only jacket? If I'm not mistaken, when he was first elected.
Exactly. So it's very easy to sort of think, well, we don't think he's quite as bad as the last guy, so therefore he's someone we can do business with. Are you in any way optimistic, or is it one of those we'll just have to suck it and see?
Look, I'm not going to be a neoconservative and argue that, you know, it's always a world of good versus evil. It's a very gray world, and I think I would obviously be optimistic. I think there is potential. At some stage, these two countries need to get their relationship in order. Iran is, you know, clearly a strong regional power. There are long-term issues versus the Saudis, Shia-Sunni issues out there that need to be resolved, and Iran obviously has a lot of problems, issues with its economy, so that pressure adds up to some need for change on the part of the Iranians, but also, frankly, on the part of the region. I think to deal with Iran, these issues need to be worked with. So I do think I'm optimistic there will be some change. And if I had to say I'm optimistic, it will be good change. I don't believe there will be a conflict.
And George, Greg mentions there the relationship with Saudi Arabia. Rouhani's also said he might be willing to visit Saudi Arabia. I mean, we can talk about US and Russia all we want as a difficult relationship, but none are as difficult or as potent, really, as Iran and Saudi Arabia, are they?
No, they certainly aren't. And I think it was the WikiLeaks cables that revealed one of the Saudi Arabian king talking about how he wished somebody, presumably America, would chop the head off the snake. He was referring to Iran. Not a great start for these kinds of things, but it goes back a very long way. I think it's not so much that you assume that somebody who is quote-unquote a moderate is suddenly going to see your point of view. The issue is the potential of openness to think about different things and not just run down ideological train tracks and remain culturally very isolated. And what little we know, and actually we know very little so far about Rouhani in truth, suggests to us that he is somebody who would feel confident with outsiders. One of the things that often tends to interrupt these dialogues is that people who have really spent no time dealing with people from other cultures are just in a position of clenched nervousness, which allows them to really do nothing which you need to do in negotiation. Explore possibilities without committing yourself. Understand, work out the consequences as you go. He seems to be good at that kind of thing. We're speculating on, let's face it, very small scraps of evidence.
Well, I think let's end on positive speculation.
Optimism reigns.
Yes, indeed. George Brock, head of journalism at City University and author of Out of Print, Newspapers, Journalism and the Business News in the Digital Age. Can I just ask, can I buy that book in print?
You absolutely can, but you can buy it in ebook as well.
Okay, excellent. Good. Buy it now. And Greg Beichmann, Global Head of Multimedia at Reuters, thank you both for joining us on Aperitivo. Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Aperitivo. I'm going to tell you all about that in a moment.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Aperitivo. It is 18:30 here in London. We'll be heading to the Monocle Cafe to talk design with Will Knight. We'll also head to San Francisco, where our correspondent dips his toes into this year's America's Cup competition. And if that's not enough, we'll play some music and also preview what's coming up on today's Globus Asia and Monocle Daily. But before all that, here's David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you. At least six people have been killed in a shooting at the US Navy base in Washington, D.C. One of the dead is a police officer, while one attacker has also been killed. Officials believe there are two other gunmen still on the loose at the base. The United Nations has confirmed that chemical weapons have been used in Syria. In a report issued in the last hour, it says it's established unequivocally and objectively that sarin gas was used in a rocket attack in Damascus. Engineering teams working to lift the wrecked Costa Concordia upright have managed to move the stricken liner by a few degrees. The vessel has lain on its side for more than 20 months off the Tuscan holiday island of Giglio. 32 people died in the accident. The most senior woman police officer in Afghanistan's Helmand province has died in hospital a day after being shot by unidentified gunmen. Lieutenant Agar was shot in the provincial capital, Lashkargah. Bombardier's new C-Series airliner has had its maiden flight. It took off in Quebec to cheers from watching crowds, capping a five-year, $3.4 billion development of the first all-new plane in its class in decades. Rock star and global campaigner Bob Geldof has been awarded the Freedom of the City of London in recognition to services to music and for his charity work, particularly in Africa. He was once a young homeless man on the streets of the UK capital. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Yeah, I think Geldof's probably been given that more for his charity work than his music. I mean, other than I Don't Like Mondays, can you name any other Boomtown Rat song?
Rat Trap.
Okay, I'm asking the wrong person, aren't I? you once listened to Bob Geldof make a speech in Hull. This sounds like the start of the most terrible anecdote, but go on.
It was an extraordinary business event in Hull, which is in the northeast coast of England, and Bob Geldof was there, Elle Macpherson and George Foreman, all doing speeches as part of this business sort of hub.
George Foreman, Elle Macpherson and Bob Geldof in Hull.
It was. I had to pinch myself. I have to say, though, that Bob Geldof's speech was the most extraordinary thing I've ever witnessed. It was
he's a
inspirational.
Great public speaker.
And I just sort of sat there agog, and I had to shake his hand afterwards because I thought it was amazing. But the mix of people there was quite extraordinary in Hull.
In Hull, which, yeah, if you don't know Hull... Well, that's good for you, to be honest. David Spencer, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Aperitivo live here on Monocle 24. It's 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, and 14:33 in Rio. Now, every day on Aperitivo, we'll be leaving the comfortable confines of Studio One here at Midori House and popping down the road to the equally well-appointed Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street. So let's head back there right now. Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck is waiting with Will Knight, director of 100% Design. It's the largest design trade event in the UK with over 25,000 visitors, and it all kicks off this Wednesday. Andrew, over to you.
Thank you, Steve. Yes, we're well appointed here as well. We've got a very good lineup of guests, and I think we can outdo Bob Geldof as well with inspiration, hopefully, over the next 5 minutes. As you said, I'm joined by Will Knight. And Will, I wanted to ask you, first of all, you know, there are so many design events around the world these days. You know, we have the big beast of Milan, but I think in the next few weeks we've got Helsinki, we've got next month, we've got Amsterdam. Where does London sit in that array, and what's special about London?
Well, I think it's natural for me to put London, of course, right at the top of the pile, not least because we're in the middle of the London Design Festival. London is a unique I think, offering in the design world. It doesn't really bear comparison in lots of ways to more established things like Milan, because it's very focused on the furniture industry and it has its roots back into Italian manufacturing, whereas London is more driven from the cultural side. And I think the ability to draw people in, doing public installations, allowing a kind of proliferation of different events to take place across the city, gives it an edge which is quite frankly unparalleled, I think, in any other city.
Now, while we were waiting to come on air, we were talking about the fact that British people seem to be obsessed about building their own homes, about decorating their own homes, and there is quite a lot of design, 100% design, that is about the domestic environment. And I wondered if you felt that the kind of the vibrancy of the event and what people were buying was a good reflection of the economy. You know, here in London we have a kind of booming real estate industry yet again. Do you feel that the success of the show is partly down to, you know, how many architects have got kind of big deals lined up?
I think undoubtedly we are very much a part and a product of economic well-being and, you know, the ability to spend and invest in good design. I think the messaging around the value of doing so has begun to really get through, and you see end users, but you also see property developers investing and actually exploring design issues rather than spending on bigger kind of bling projects, if you like. But ultimately, design comes at a price. You're investing in something that is intended to be both functional and, of course, have a form which is attractive for one user who's investing in it, but it may be something that lasts a generation. It's an investment as much as anything else. So, absolutely, I think there is a reflection of how London's property scene has, you know, again picked up very, very rapidly. And I suspect the visitors we'll have at the show this year will be, you know, a product of those times.
Now, tell me what are some of the ingredients you need for a successful design show. Are you hoping that people will be launching products and bringing new things to market there? Is it just a numbers game? Is it at the end of the day when the people there who have participated say, actually, we've taken this X, you know, £1,000 in orders? What makes it a successful event for you?
Well, there are a huge number of things that go into making an event like 100% Design. We've got 20,000 square meters of content, which is a huge amount of people, products, ideas, concepts, many of which are end products and they're ready for market and they're being launched at the show, which of course is a testament to investment by companies, brands, designers who want to come and do that, use it as a launch pad. But I think it's also about the experience of going to a show like 100% Design. By its nature, being a design experience is quite important. So as the organizers, we've invested a huge amount in the commissioning of the design experience. We have a dedicated tunnel entrance, a huge central bar, which is decorated with a fantastic Czech-designed chandelier. We've got an auditorium, which has been designed by Benjamin Hubert, who's a true star of the British design scene at the moment, British product design scene at the moment. So I think the experience is also quite important because we want people to enjoy it whilst they're there, but we want them to come back year on year. It's very important to build momentum around something like a design event. But ultimately, I think the bottom line is about opportunity. You have to be able to create opportunity both for the visitor to connect with a product or a service or a designer that they want to be able to engage and to obviously work with. Also, from an exhibitor perspective, we want them to be able to contact that market, provide access to architects, interior designers, who are the kind of main body of our visitors, but quite frankly also the press, other people that come in and are picking up on themes, trends, ideas that dominate 1 year's experience at the show.
Now, just before we finish, just tell me quickly one or two highlights we should look out for this.
Well, I've mentioned some of the kind of physical aspects, but I think certainly on the show itself, there's a fantastic program that we've developed called Talks with 100% Design. Richard Rogers, who, as we know, has been much celebrated in London this year, is the opening speaker for that. We also had Giulio Capellini headlining, and we were lucky enough to have Nigel Coates coming along to give him an insight into his particular take on design as well. So Talks are fantastic. And also the installations we've done. So for each section of the show, we've commissioned an incredibly bunch of talented people to come and do very specially commissioned concerts.
Well, Will Knight, director of 100% Design, thank you. I know it's a kind of your crazy moment for you building actually everything down at Earls Court. So thank you very much for coming here. Just to let everybody know, it's 3 days for the trade, but there is a day for the public. So if you want tickets, you just need to go onto the 100% Design website, and you'll be very welcome if you head down there. Back to you now, Steve, in the studio.
Andrew, thank you very much indeed. That was our editor, Andrew Tuck, talking to Will Knight, director of 100% Design. You're listening to Aperitivo. Up after the break, Monocle correspondent Alistair G finds out the highs and lows of the world's oldest and possibly most prestigious sporting competition, the America's Cup.
The Aperitivo is brought to you in association with the Glenlivet. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all, and on it lives.
You're listening to Monocle 24. Join us at 2200 hours London time and end the day with the Monocle Daily, live every weekday.
It's gone bedtime, really, frankly, if you're in Hong Kong. 1:40 in the morning on Tuesday. You should be asleep by now. 20:40 in Helsinki, 18:40 here in London. You're listening to Aperitivo with me, Steve Bloomfield. In San Francisco, one of the world's premier sailing events is currently taking place. It's almost coming to an end. The America's Cup pits seafaring nations against each other in rather futuristic boats that almost fly as well as they sail. But as Monocle's Alistair G reports, the Cup hasn't quite enjoyed the universally rapturous reception that its organised would have hoped for.
On a freshly renovated pier on San Francisco Bay, thousands of people have gathered for a race between two ships, with futuristic sails that resemble the wing of an airplane and sleek, almost avian profiles. The flags of the United States and New Zealand flutter in the crowd of visitors.
Oh, absolutely amazing machines. Really good-looking boats, amazingly fast. And as soon as I saw them pop out of the water the first time, that's when I decided I was coming here.
It's a spaceship of sailing.
Yeah, I was about to say, a spaceship.
This is the America's Cup, one of the most prestigious sailing contests in the world and also the oldest major sporting event. This year's event in San Francisco has all the competitors sailing a specially designed boat called the AC-72, which travels at unheard-of speeds and even has the ability to hydrofoil, lifting almost completely out of the water as it races along at over 40 knots. But despite the technological breakthroughs, the competition has been mired in controversy, with fewer benefits to the host city than anticipated, and even the death of a sailor. For the competitors, the preparations for the Cup have taken years. Just ask Paul Kajard, the CEO of Sweden's Artemis, one of the teams that has competed for the Cup this year. Kajard, a native San Franciscan who has taken part in the Olympics and multiple America's Cups, says the training is intense.
The sailing team is in the gym every day at 7 o'clock, 7:30 till about 9. Breakfast, a briefing meeting, dock out at 11. Meanwhile, that the sailing team is doing that, the shore team is putting the boat in the water, putting the wing up, checking all the electronics, checking all the software. The tender team is getting all the tenders ready and the safety gear ready to support the boat during the day. And, you know, there's a 3 or 4 hour activity on the water.
He adds that the AC-72, while exhilarating, presents particular challenges.
Everything's fast, so that means that your reaction times have to be quicker, your anticipation has to be better. You chew up a mile in about 2 or 3 minutes. And so coming to the marks, the turning marks, you have to plan way far ahead.
Kajard's team was knocked out this summer, months after one of the Artemis crew was killed when the boat broke up on the water. And the Cup has been dogged by other problems. Originally, it was estimated that it would bring $1.4 billion of economic activity to the city, but that has since been revised down to less than a billion, and there are fewer visitors than expected. What's more, owing to the expense of the boats and the poor economy, only 4 teams entered the competition this summer: Italy, Sweden, New Zealand, and the US, and not the anticipated 15.
I think just about everyone in San Francisco, certainly people in the neighborhood, were very excited at the idea of America's Cup. The reality has been much more of a disappointment.
That's John Gollinger, a member of a neighborhood association in the tourist-friendly Telegraph Hill District. He blames the problems on politicians and on Larry Ellison, the billionaire CEO of Oracle, whose team won the previous America's Cup and so, according to the rules of the competition, was permitted to choose this year's host city and the type of boat used.
I mean, Larry Ellison and the America's Cup Event Authority, you know, really lobbied and pushed the city very hard 2 years ago to sign a deal right around Christmas time very quickly under the pressure of, we're going to take this somewhere else unless you give us a huge, incredibly sweet deal. And they made a lot of promises, and I think I don't know of anyone who would say those promises have come true. So I think, you know, City Hall also deserves a lot of blame, or the politicians were asleep at the wheel.
Still, those involved with the Cup's organization say it has by no means been a total bust. Norbert Bajorin is head of the Golden Gate Yacht Club, the official home of the defending USA team. He says that the problems are not the result of high-pressure lobbying, but rather merely a bad economy. He admits that the costly, high-performance boats were an idiosyncratic choice.
The 72s? Yeah, a little extreme, definitely, and we learned.
He argues that whatever issues have cropped up, San Francisco remains an ideal location for the Cup.
I mean, it is a natural amphitheater. I mean, it's a perfectly good bay. It's you can see from 360 degrees all around you. The sailing is competitive here. We got strong currents and strong ebbs against the wind. So to sail out here, it's not really for a novice. It's for professionals.
Back at the America's Cup Pier, those who have travelled around the world to see the racing aren't talking much about the problems the contest has faced.
Yeah, no, I love it. I think it's so exciting for New Zealand to be back in the America's Cup, and there's a real buzz at home, and yeah, it's good to hear lots of Kiwis over here too.
On the bay, meanwhile, the America and the New Zealand boats are heading out for their next race. Watching the spectators crowd at the railings, it's clear that the Cup has indeed brought money and visitors to San Francisco. Just not quite in the amounts that the city was hoping for. For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alastair G.
You're listening to Aperitivo. Up next, I'll be joined by Tom Lewis and Mark Cosippi to look ahead to the rest of the day on Monocle 24. But first, this is new and brilliant from Arcade Fire. It's Reflector. Arcade Fire with Reflector. The album is out at the end of next month. And then they're touring. Have you got your tickets, Tom Lewis?
Not yet. I'm hoping they haven't sold out yet, Steve.
Marcus Hippie, have you got yours?
I don't have them yet, no. I haven't actually. I'm not that familiar with this band, you know, believe it or not.
Really? Not with Arcade Fire? Okay, right.
Not big in Finland.
Well, there's a start of your education.
If that's really sort of what we're going on, whether it's big or not in Finland. Anyway, you will have heard Tom Lewis and Marcus Hippie are here because although we're fast approaching the end of Aperitivo, there is much more still to come on Monocle 24 later today, including the Globus Asia, which Tom Lewis is producing, and the Monocle Daily, which Marcus Hippie is presenting, not producing.
Exactly.
Although you're tapping away furiously there on your laptop.
Working on the script already.
Working on the script. Tom, we're obviously going to start with on Globus Asia with the news out of Washington. What's the latest?
Yes, it's a pretty fluid story and a pretty grim one at that, Steve. Another shooting story from the USA, which is how President Barack Obama described it within the past hour. We believe so far that there are at least six people dead about three or four more injured, but they're very fluid numbers and have only just been confirmed now. This shooting happened 8:30-ish local time at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C., which is a big headquarters where submarines and other naval equipment are repaired and built and developed. The area in southeastern Washington, D.C. is still under lockdown, and as I say, the information is very fluid. So we'll be speaking to Amber Phillips, our contributor there, who will be bringing us up to date with what she knows.
Okay. Also in that show, we're talking about Syria with a twist. In fact, both our serious stories this evening, with taking slightly different angles. On the global stage, we're going to be looking at how Sweden has announced in recent days that it's willing to take as many Syrian refugees as want to turn up there. And so we're going to have a look at why Sweden's taken so many and which other countries are stepping up to the plate.
That's right. So Sweden announced last Tuesday, I believe, that for Syrian refugees who are already in the country, they would be given indefinite leave to stay, effectively. They would be given residence permits, and their families who are still in Syria or in other countries would also be allowed to apply and would likely get residency too. So I spoke to a member of the Migration Board in Stockholm earlier today, and they said that their evaluation was made on how serious they believed the Syrian crisis to be becoming, kind of especially the international diplomacy that's going so far. So we'll be in Canada and also in Colombia, countries you don't really hear too often in the news of taking Syrian refugees, and we'll be hearing what the situation is there.
My most interesting fact on migration is this. Did you know, Marcus Hippie, that the city of Malmo has taken more Iraqi refugees than the whole of the UK?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it wasn't even their war.
I can actually say about that story that Finland is actually thinking about what to do, because it doesn't really look that good for Finland to get to take so little Syrian refugees. The number is 300-something, and they're looking at Sweden that is getting so many more.
Well, the problem Sweden's found itself in is that embassies around the world have seen these queues of Syrians who are in other countries kind of thinking they can get in, but that's not actually the process. So maybe that's maybe something Finland might be looking at stepping in that case.
So we'll look at that a little bit later in the Globus Asia. Now, in the Monocle Daily, we're obviously going to be talking about Syria as well. And Marcus, the thing we're going to be looking at there is the role of female reporters in Syria. There was a really, frankly, stupid op-ed in The Guardian over the weekend.
I was just going to ask how you feel about that writing.
It was awful. It was a woman saying why... it was also the way she phrased it. She said, do women know how to find Syria on the map? And she was trying to make a serious point that she felt all the voices talking about Syria were men. What she failed to do was realise that almost all the reporters doing the actual reporting on the ground are overwhelmingly women.
Exactly. It's an undeniable fact that female journalists are behind some of the most important reporting coming from that region. And this piece in this newspaper actually caused quite a lot of anger amongst those reporters, and there's been a lot of discussion about that. So therefore, we're going to be speaking to some of those female journalists who have actually been working in Syria. We're going to be talking about why it may sometimes seem that they are not as visible as the male journalists are. And we're also going to be talking about their work. What is it actually like being a female reporter in that region, and what it takes when it comes to, say, security measurements.
And one of those reporters we'll be speaking to is Emma Beals, who's just actually come back from Syria. Also on the show tonight, Marcus, it looks like we're one step closer to finding out the identity of New York City's new mayor.
Exactly. Interesting case. Democrat Bill Thompson dropped out of the race for New York City mayor at an event at City Hall.
He'd been
Monday
clinging on,
morning.
Really, hadn't he? It was because Bill de Blasio had essentially won, but there was some issue over whether he'd reached the 40% cutoff to prevent any sort of runoff. Bill Thompson had been like saying, oh, no, don't worry, I might still be able to get there.
He did cling on by the skin of his teeth, but eventually the game was up.
Yeah,
today.
De Blasio indeed is the party's nominee now, and it seems that he's got a fair chance of winning indeed. On the Monocle Daily, we actually finish with a phone call to North America, not to the US, though. We are going to be calling St. John's, Newfoundland. We are going to be speaking to an editor of the Telegram newspaper.
This is my favourite segment on the Monocle Daily. It's every Monday night, is talking to the editor of a newspaper a little bit further away from where we normally go, in a slightly, you know, more remote part of the world.
It's always
like a Finland or a Wales.
we haven't had a Welsh far-flung yet. I should work on that.
Well, no, genuinely, I'd like to know, you know, what's going on in the valleys.
There is a Welsh language newspaper produced in New Jersey, of all places.
Is there really?
Very small, indeed.
By the way, Steve, have you mentioned that you're actually going to go to see Santa Claus in Lapland in just a couple of days? I think you should start doing your research beforehand and start reading those.
You're delivering your letter.
Finnish Lapland newspapers.
That is true. We are doing an Arctic-themed issue for Monocle magazine. I was hoping to keep this bit of a bit of a secret until now, but you've let the cat out of the bag.
Is that Santa
that
you're
there's going to be, because every issue we do a national icon, and I thought, well, for the Arctic, what better national icon than Santa? Marcus, you want to say something?
That is so good. I have a question.
Yeah, go on.
Are you going to sit on his lap?
I've only got one question for him, really, which is naughty or nice. It's funny, I've been asking lots of people in the office, do you want me to take a letter to Santa? And a number of people have been like, oh, yeah, could you ask him for a new kitchen? Could you ask him if he could replace my sash windows? They're more expensive than I thought.
It's not really the romance of Christmas.
It's
then,
not really,
is it?
Marcus Hippie, Tom Lewis, thank you both very much. So stay with Monocle 24 because Globist Asia is coming up in just under an hour. That's 2000 hours London time. Marcus will be here with Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. That's all we have time for on Aperitivo. Many thanks in particular to George Brock and Greg Beichmann, who talked us through the US-Russia-Syria deal. Here's a bit of what George Brock had to say on Syria.
Every chemical weapons monitoring expert who anybody's ever talked to says, this is really big scale stuff, this. We're just not looking for a few cans here.
Today's show was produced by Daniel Dracopelli. It was researched by Alexa Firmanich, and our studio manager was Sam Impey. Andrew Tuck and Jack Phillips were the team down at the cafe. Next up is Culture with Rob Bound. Then, of course, it's the Globus Asia. And then, of course, it's Marcus with the Monocle Daily. Aperitivo will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time, 1300 hours in New York. But for all of us here at Midori House, and indeed down at the Monocle Cafe, thank you very much for listening to the first ever edition of Aperitivo. My name's Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.